ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC AFL Daily for your Tuesday. Corbin Middlemass alongside Bob Murphy, who's in on his holidays to sit here and chop up all the hot button issues out of the Monday night footy shows. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning to you, Corbin. Nice to be in your company.
There's a very special inquiry on Four Corners last night, which we'll get into as well.
Not an easy watch, that one.
Oh, special investigation into CTE and brain trauma in the game of Australian rules football. And obviously that's highly relevant for what we do and talk about. And your experiences, Bob, obviously as someone that had a two-decade-long career. So we'll touch on all of that as we work our way through. You meant to be on break, but here you are, still following the footy in the depths of winter.
No such thing as a day off in the world of AFL Daily podcast on a Tuesday.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Speaking of holidays, Caro's back from holidays.
Caro's back.
Which means
fresh.
We got some new content.
Good off a spell too, Caro.
We got some new content to be able to talk about. She was back on Agenda Setters last night. And of course, the coach search is on big time for three clubs in the competition. The Devils, along with the Blues and the Bombers, who were topical again last night on Channel 7.
Yeah, so Andrew Welsh and James Hood have spoken. I think they might have spoken. I'm pretty sure they've spoken more than once. But Andrew Welsh called James Hurd. I think it was last Friday or Saturday. They spoke about the Essendon coaching job. James Hurd, well, it's pretty clear he wants to coach Essendon. Newsflash. My understanding is, Tom, that it might have been put to James whether he would consider, and I know you asked Dean Solomon the reverse option over the weekend after the Essendon-North game, but my understanding is that Andrew Welsh asked James Hurd whether he would consider another role at the football club and not that of senior coach.
So do you think this was a subtle way of him, or a nice way of him saying, you're not going to be the coach of Essendon, but we want you to be involved. Would you consider a role that he's not the senior coach?
Now, look,
was that the intention of that call? What was the tone of the call?
I think James Hurd wants an interview, and I think the decision has been made that he will get an interview. I can tell you what James Hurd's response was to the question as to whether...
Well, I think we all know.
I think it's not interested.
So you said...
Interested in any job at Essendon bar the senior
coach. Which I'm not surprised by.
So reportedly, if it's not the senior coaching job, not interested, James Hurd, in being in any sort of other role at Essendon.
So in listening to... So Caro has the story and Kane's question, which was where my mind went to straight away. So if you were a part of James Hurd's inner circle, and that was relayed to you that's what Andrew Welsh put forward within that conversation, it's not a huge vote of confidence, is it, for the direction of the president? That's how I would have taken
that. Not before the process has even started. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know this has been reported along the way as, you know, it would be shocking if it's not Hurd or Solomon, and it's been built as somewhat as a match race. I feel like, and people that listen to our show, I've been pretty consistent the whole way along, that if it's Hurd or Solomon, or the field, I'm still very happy to be on the field, as I have been the whole way through. I just feel like, to Essendon's credit, this has been very quiet. There's been very few leaks come out of it. And so for all the talk at the start and the...
For how loud and bombastic it was within the first 48 hours and then the next couple of weeks.
And then essentially you think the actual people that are making the decision at the club, they've kept it very quiet. They haven't been rushed. They said all along, we're working on our timeline. They put their panel together. It's the internal figures that it has been all along. And so for all the stuff that's been thrown at them from the outside about, you know, Solomon's the preferred candidate, it's either Hurd or Solomon, you know, James Hurd's going to unite the club, there's going to be all this backlash if they don't appoint him. It feels like all that smoke is cleared and they're going to get the opportunity to run some kind of a process here. So I would still be on anyone else than those two, I think, is the likely candidate. You're not with me on that?
No, absolutely I am. The longer it goes, it feels like as the intensity and the hyperbole and all the emotion starts to drift away from it. And it's almost as all of that noise and hysteria drifts, we just get a clearer picture of what's happening on the field. And what's happening on the field at the moment is damning. It's dreadful. And I think that's probably where the focus should be more in real terms. James Hurd is a fascination to all of us. I don't profess to be putting anything original on the table at all. But even in just hearing Caro and that panel discuss it. And there's that scoff of course he only wants to be the senior coach at Essendon and that's it. I just sort of think of, I mean, and I can understand his personal redemption. He wants to close the circle on this. And then there's the wanting to galvanise the Essendon Footy Club, which he has, you know, obvious and deep connections with. It just feels like the order for me is a little bit out. I would have thought to be a senior coach, there has to be that core foundation of I can make young footballers, or I can make footballers better. I can show them a way. Yep. I can nurture this. There's a purity and a sincerity to just the actual coaching part of it. It just feels like that's the third priority. It's like personal redemption, galvanize the club, and then I'll coach. And that may be unfair, but that's how I...
And in fairness to Hurd, we haven't heard from him directly on that. But
no,
it is.
But the only, I suppose the biggest clue around that is he's not interested in coaching anyone else.
Yeah.
Which held him back the last time at Essendon. That was something that went against him when he went up against Brad Scott.
Yeah.
I wonder how people feel about that. You can cut it different ways, but for Essendon people
I agree. I'm an Essendon fan. They're the questions that I have and want to ask essentially to James is, why didn't you do that? Why didn't you go to another club? And James Hurd's mainly the reason I barracked for Essendon. I was a huge James Hurd fan as a kid. I would love to see him become a senior coach again.
I adored him as a player. I had to play on him a couple of times. They were difficult afternoons.
I would love to see him coach any of the other 17 clubs. Like, I just feel like the chapter at Essendon for now, it's good for both parties that I don't think they're aligned at this stage. So I don't know. It feels to me that it would still...
Who needs fiction when you've got the Essendon Footy Club at the moment?
I think he'd still have to overcome a whole lot of hurdles, I think, to get the
hurdles.
Job from here.
Nice. Nice.
Yes, it's H-I-R-D-L-E. And the on-field, as you said, on the weekend, and I heard your commentary on ABC Radio on Sunday, it was as disappointing a day as you could hope for from an Essendon point of view, given I felt like there was a lot of optimism going into the afternoon. It felt like a winnable game. Lee Montagna had a similar sentiment last night on AFL 360 as the guest host for Gary Lyon. Did a fine job alongside Jared Waitley. This is what Joey had to say last night.
It's hard to say, but they almost regressed on the weekend. I mean, they were playing a game against North Melbourne, who I know North Melbourne fans were nervous, thinking, gee, this might be one that Essendon can get up for and beat them. And when you looked at the age demographic, they were almost identical. I mean, Essendon had 10 players with 100 games experience. North Melbourne had 9. Both teams had 9 or 10 players with less than 40 games experience, so they couldn't use the age as an issue. But what I saw was a team that just looked completely lost. They don't know what they're trying to do offensively, defensively, and the one thing that you should be able to bring, doesn't matter how old you are or how young is your effort, and their pressure was just deplorable. They allowed North Melbourne, who aren't the offensive juggernaut of some teams in the competition, to waltz down the field and do as they pleased. And I was really, really disappointed with what I saw from Essendon.
So 35 tackles and what a pressure rating in the low 150s.
It reminded me of when they came up against Fremantle early in the year, when that was when Brad Scott was coaching, and it was one of those games that was sort of the beginning of the end of Brad Scott's time, because the structure looked skittish, and then the underlying appetite to defend and try hard was not there. So you can try an AFL and you can then really try, and the lack of tackling pressure and the amount of broken tackles, it just stood out, and you could see it. It was sort of magnified because you had guys like Mason Redman and Durham who were trying.
Yeah.
And you think, well, there's a level of care and commitment that they have, and the drop-off was stark.
So I guess this is the entire art of coaching, isn't it? I mean, if you've got a playing group that just doesn't want to do it, like, what do you do about that? Like, if you're Dean Solomon, his thing was he's going to be this huge galvaniser for the club and everything else, and he's got a long runway, which can work for and against you, as we're finding out in the two scenarios that run concurrently between Carlton and Essendon. But what do you do about that? Like, if you're Dean Solomon this week, do we need to make a statement at selection? Like, how do you get the guys to do the absolute basics that you'd expect of your park team on Saturday afternoon?
It's difficult to know because we're not inside, but a general rule of thumb would be make it easier to understand. Just take the complexity out of it. None of this, we're going to run a player off the back of the square. No, just condense it into as basic a structure and formula as you can that still is relevant to AFL footy, but just less out of here
and
play from there.
but more, let's lay 80 tackles today. Let's, yeah, whatever it turns out to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, if you go back to the Ben Rutten days, that was something that this group had, that in Ben Rutten's days, and he was only there for 2 years, but they were a tackling machine. Mm. They laid regularly high-end tackles, and at least the blue-collar stuff, the dirty work you felt was there for whatever they were missing
talent-wise. Yeah, and it's not just tackles, but when you're watching live and you see that there's a lot of players who you watch, this is the Essendon model at the moment. Oh, do I have to? There's a lot of looking around, and then, oh, yeah. Good teams aren't, oh, do I have to? They are kind of desperate to do it. Oh, I can't wait for the opportunity. I dare you to come in the middle of the ground.
Yeah.
I dare you. What, you wait till you do it. I'm on the toes. I'm looking forward. Come on. Go on. I dare you. Go in the middle. They're on their heels back, and then it's, it's too late.
So he's been in the interim doing his chances more harm than good for Dean Solomon?
Oh, the weekend would have hurt a little bit. But, I mean, he's been given. He hasn't been given a lot. But there's something... They're in just such a spinning the wheels mode at the moment, and it's a long way out from home.
Yeah.
To be playing soulless footy, they need to get it back pretty quick.
Just quickly, while we're on this, so Carlton, obviously their coach search is underway. Mitch Cleary on Seven News last night, their chief footy reporter, released or reported that Jamie Graham, along with James Kelly, James Riley, Daniel Jeon, Syracuse, Brendan Lade, and Corey Enright, are among the six confirmed candidates that are going to get interviews from the Carlton Football Club. Mitch did say, as part of that report, it's not limited to, but includes these guys. And they're as a higher credentialed six that you could possibly find in the assistant coaching ranks at the moment.
Yeah, not a heap of surprises there. Jamie Graham's an interesting one. Spent a lot of time with Jamie at Fremantle and really highly regarded. Just missed out Collingwood.
Yeah, ran deep with McRae and Kingsley.
Yeah, ran really deep. And he's a WA boy. His family firmly entrenched in WA. Didn't put his hand up for the West Coast job at the time, which I think was surprised a lot of people, including at Fremantle. But Jamie he's someone who could absolutely step into a senior AFL coaching role. So that's I'm intrigued by that. If he is putting his hand up, I'm still pretty staunch that Corey Enright is the front runner, and I mean, it looks like confirmation that they'll pursue an untried coach at senior AFL level.
Yeah. X's,
which is interesting. I still, even though that's what I was expecting, I am sort of interested by that.
Yeah. Is there a chance that Josh Fraser just makes it undeniable still? Like, if he just keeps winning?
Well, his chances keep rising for sure.
It's going to be hard to ignore, though, isn't it? To say, hey, we've got this.
Has he put his hand up yet?
No.
No.
Not publicly.
I'm getting a bit of heat on our social channels from a few supporters saying he definitely won't. He's said that he won't. Well, let's just put the clock on it. He will. He absolutely will put his hand up for it at some point, as will Dean Solomon.
But if he's got the whole supporter base behind him and they go on and play finals, and I mean that we're going to get to see a few of these things play out, where a lot of people are saying, oh, but they're playing with such freedom now, so it's easy to do that. Essentially, the pressure's released. Well, they've got such a long runway that at some point they're going to be playing for a wild card spot, and the level of pressure is going to go up, and they're going to be in these high stakes games.
If they win finals, or even if they go deep into really big games, that will carry a fair bit of weight. But they will lose one at some point.
Yep. I think the conversation changes though if they make the wild card, though, doesn't it? Yeah. Like, I almost think that it's gonna run that deep for them. I think if they have success and ultimately miss, I think it's going to be easy enough for Carlton to say, oh, we're going to go in another direction. But if he gets there. And that, like, remembering, they're in a better position than they were in 2023 when they made the prelim. What if they make a really deep run?
Well, if they make a really deep run, it's game on.
Yep.
It's game on. I still hold this view that Carlton don't really want to appoint an interim coach.
Yep.
That's my gut feel.
No doubt.
And so if there's a belting along the way,
yep,
that will be weighed heavily against Josh.
Or Richmond this week.
Fairly or unfairly, I'm not sure.
No caretaker coach has ever won the first four games. And he's now at six, about to be seven. So amazing with Richmond this weekend. Let's skip over to On the Couch. There's a bit happening on the couch last night, I thought, with the quartet back together. It's great to see Jonathan Brown back on the couch. And there was a conversation last night about Damien Hardwick. And, of course, his famous statement when he got to the Gold Coast Suns about the fact that 80% of the premiership team is in this room currently when he was appointed in late 2023.
You know, I think 80% of our first premiership side is sitting in this room right now.
Not only challenging, but saluting in the not too distant future. And they couldn't look further from it at
you,
the moment.
You know, would it, he would clearly regret that.
I think it was a huge statement. It was a huge statement, and I believe they've probably given that group that was sitting under Damien Hardwick a bit of a sugar hit. The three-time premiership coaches come in and believe that natural progression was going to get them to the promised land and get them winning a premiership. And at the moment, they are on a lull. They are nowhere to be seen, and I doubt that the 80% of the next premiership team for the Gold Coast was in the room that day, and certainly with the changes.
So that was a bit of a salesman dimmer, though, wasn't it, to sell AFL on the Gold Coast and all that. Like, he's got to pump up the brand. Like, clearly, he would need 6 months with a team with a list to think, oh, geez, you know, is this the list or do we need to move some players?
Surely an experienced coach going into that environment wouldn't suggest that if he didn't actually believe it.
Did he believe it or was he selling the team?
I think he believed enough of it. 80 was high. And it was a dramatic number. It's not a literal number. So the way I viewed it, and this is why sport is so interesting, Jack Riewoldt refers to it as a sugar hit.
Yep.
I would refer to it as lifting the horizons of the Gold Coast Footy Club. So it was not just the players. It's the coaches. It's the administration. It's the board of start setting your sights and ambitions higher.
Yep.
That this is actually all we need. We don't need the Messiah. We don't need the superstar. We have enough here to win it. That's how I...
Yep.
And I love when leaders are bold and they go after and they actually set their sights on something. So you can litigate the number and it's not a tax return.
Yeah.
80s, you know, the 80% of the play. It's like, okay, like
the
point as I hear it, he's trying to make is... We have enough here to win it.
Do you reckon he thought when he was sitting there in 2023 that it would be more than this in 2026 on a 5-game losing skid and outside the 10?
Certainly when you highlight this year, it would be like that's a disappointment. That we are far better than that.
Mm.
There's a fair bit of history of teams that build, drop one,
yep,
and then go again. So I'm not jumping off Gold Coast just yet.
Yeah. Do they still have noise to make this season? So he's now talking about, it's an 8-week season. If we win more than we lose, we'll play in the wild card. And it feels like even by his own language and the way he's talking, gee, it's a different conversation than what it was through the first 3 weeks when they were premiership favourites.
I almost think it's time for the 8-week season is really about next season.
Yeah.
So externally, it'll get loud and it'll be critical and, they're no good and it's the same old Gold Coast. It may be a blessing in disguise for them.
What do you tell the guys that are got one eye on the exit? Whoever wants to, is it one of those moments again for the Suns where it's like, right, whoever wants to go, now's the time. What do you do everything you can to hold people to their contracts?
That's what I want to do.
Yep.
That's how I sort of view it. I understand, I suspect it's very different at the Gold Coast.
If
you want to go, now's the time. Actually, no worries.
10 of them.
Hey! What I meant 80% of that. I understand. It's probably a different beast up there, but the longer view of it of where they've built the last few years.
Mm.
They've dropped one this year.
Let's stay on the couch. And the all-conquering Fremantle Football Club, who have won 14 on the bounce. I read during the week it's not just now a record for any WA-based AFL team. It is a record for any team in any sports league based out of WA.
And that is... Hang on, say that again.
Any team based out of WA. So better run than the Wildcats have ever gone on, or the West Coast Fever, or whoever it turns out to be. No WA-based sporting team has ever won 14 consecutive games.
So they're the pride of WA.
They are.
Without actually winning anything.
And they were topical on the couch last night.
The final started now. I couldn't see them getting beaten, Jack.
Really?
The final started now. Their game is in such good shape.
Bucks, you know, Justin Longmire, are you surprised how big of a shift this has been from the defensive mentality of him? It's the thing that people question you about, how defensively focused they were. They've been able to maintain that aspect, but there has been this ramp for them.
No, I'm not surprised. I think it was overblown, the criticism over the last couple of years in particular. So I think that Fremantle have been really solid. And their game plan, I think sometimes you just got to build years of playing together to reach a critical mass where you can actually go and take advantage of that. And I think Fremantle have taken a very strategic, very measured approach to this list build. And I think that we're just seeing a side mature. It's still work to do because they've got to take that step to be winning finals in September. Mm. And we saw with Adelaide last year that that's still another hurdle to get over.
So it's a good cautionary tale. Obviously, the Crows, who were minor premiers last year, but they won 18 games for the season. This team has won 14 in a row. Mm. And for the history lesson around this century, 14-game win streaks, it's only or more, has happened 7 times. All 7 have gone on to playoff in the grand final. 4 of them have won the premiership, 3 times the runner-up. So we have a dominant team in our competition.
Yeah, and theirs to lose.
Maybe based off history and everything else, maybe we're a little bit slow to acknowledge them as that. It sort of feels like, Fremantle are dominant, but we haven't seen it in September yet, and there's almost this asterisk on it. Is it time to start talking about them as the dominant force that they've shown to be?
Oh, yeah. I think at this point, after the Geelong victory, I was like, okay, that's...
So you're saying theirs to lose?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I would think so. Yep. I think the Hawthorn, Brisbane, Sydney, but Sydney on grand final day is a separate conundrum. But yeah, I think Fremantle, and I would put Fremantle in a different category than Adelaide last year of the years of build being very strategic. So I think whilst there is the doubt and there is the, you know, being the first Fremantle team to win one is a real thing. But I think there's a more solidified belief within that team that they're the real deal.
Does it help that their best players, guys like Jackson and Bolton, have won them before, even if it's elsewhere? Like, it's not as if, yes, they're getting there as a collective for the first time, but there's a bunch of guys that are got that premiership DNA.
There's something in this is what I learnt late in my footy experience at the Bulldogs, and I had an unusual perspective of it, but in leading into the grand final, you have this thing of everything has to be perfect to win a grand final. That's how I had sort of played it out in my head. And leading into 2016, that week I thought, well, it'll debunk that because everything is not perfect.
Yep.
There are holes here. There's, there's a couple of people with their nose out of joint over here. There's not absolute commitment from everyone, but you have enough. And I had a mate of mine who said, well, who's, spent a life in footy, and he said, it's about how many tickets in the barrel you have.
Yep.
If you've got enough right. So I think that, debunk what has to happen to win one, having players that have been there, it can help.
Scott Van Pelt, the ESPN sports anchor, is one of my favourite broadcasters, and he always talks about, he's a big golf fan and used to work for the Golf Channel, and talks all the time about when golfers break through and finally win majors that have been contending for a long time. And he said, golfers talk all the time about, I've got to play the 4 perfect rounds in a row. And they soon realise to become a major champion, you just actually have to believe that my good enough is good enough, that it's good enough to be there to 4 days in a row. It's not going to be perfect, but to actually have that realisation that when guys break through, it sort of reminded me of that as the what you spoke about there.
True perfection has to be imperfect. Now, Noel Gallagher sang that, so it's not exactly in the realms, but I think it says the same story.
Last one before the Four Corner special, Caroline Wilson back on Agenda Setters last night on 7.
Tim Reid, speaking of GWS, might not be one of the biggest names in football, but right now the Giants chairman confronts one of football's most crucial calls, having chosen not to re-contract the club's legendary and legacy CEO, Dave Matthews. Reid is now overseeing a club at the crossroads. Right now, nothing seems certain at the Giants. Not their out of contract, heart and soul captain, nor their future, currently sideline captain, not even their name or even a big chunk of games at the start of next season. Reid must make the next CEO his first order priority, because until he does, Toby Green won't make a call and neither will Tom Green. This is a club facing an uncertain future.
Caro went on to report that James Avery and Ben Buckley are the leading candidates, and that the AFL is actually going to sit in on the latter stages of this interview process. So Andrew Dillon and Tom Harley are going to be part of the last round of interviews. Caro went on to say that bums on seats is the priority here. They need to start filling the stadium there, where the focus has very much been, I think, under Dave Matthews' time as the CEO, that if we win, sort of build it and they will come. That clearly the focus in the past has been on football primarily, as if we got a winning team, that'll be our best way to come through and be relevant. relevant.
And of course, they haven't won one, but gee, they've been they've been a very consistent good footy team for the most part for a fair while. Has that ever happened before, where Andrew Dillon and a Tom Harley, that those positions have sat in on a CEO appointment? Like, I know that there's AFL influence, and you know their spider's web is far reaching, but that is unnerving. Yeah, that's
just goes to show that they're worried about it.
Like, more than worried.
Yeah.
It does sort of it does magnify Caro's position on it.
I'm interested in what Caro's saying there about, you know, Tom Green and Toby Green and the holdouts, basically, to see which direction the club's going and who the CEO is going to be. Has that ever been your experience? I mean, very different scenario. Obviously, you play for an old team in Melbourne that, you know, heart and soul type club and everything else. But does the CEO appointment ever impact, you know, player retention?
Apologies to any of the former CEOs at the Bulldogs in my time. No, that wasn't. A high performance manager would have held more weight than a CEO.
It's also not an ordinary club, though, is it?
No,
you think
it's
about you know, that the guys like living in the eastern suburbs. Yeah, I know there's been a lot of contention in the
and
past.
And Dave Matthews, not a typical CEO.
No.
Yeah. Felt much more entrenched in the locker room and shaping their culture as being more than content to wear the black hat. You know, being a bit of the antagonistic
disruptor,
aggressive disruptor.
Yeah. I wonder if, you know, the new CEO comes in and says, right, we all got to go live in Western Sydney and be entrenched in the area and everything else. Yeah, whether there's a few players going, well, hang on, maybe this isn't the vision that I signed up for and what I was sold when I first came to the club.
You can imagine Toby Green and Dave Matthews being in, you know, in stride.
Yep. Cameron Ling and Mick Moldhouse both said the other night they feel like he's not going to be there next year, just putting their finger in the wind. Are you the same on that?
Well, it feels like that's the way it's going. I must admit, I was initially shocked.
Yeah,
I was initially... I still am shocked, to be honest. Has that been getting as much coverage as what some might expect?
Like, if the captain of your footy club and your biggest ever figure hasn't signed at the back end of the year, you think there has to be some serious doubts. I'll tell you what has changed even...
He's a legacy man. Like, that is...
When was your last year in the game?
2017.
Yeah.
So some would say 2016.
Yeah. So we're, what, nine years ago now.
Yeah.
So I think the one thing that has changed in that time is, back then it would have been unheard of to think that a guy that spent his whole life at one club would then go and play somewhere else and finish his career and however it turns out to be.
Well, particularly captains.
Yeah.
We've seen...
Is this an advent of the NBA and NFL?
I feel like it has been.
Player movement. And so it's kind of like, my legacy's secured there, but who cares if I go and, you know, get the bag or I go and try and win another one somewhere else?
I feel like it's been a steady crawl
towards
the ESPN American model for a while now.
But you think about, like, we've had captains change clubs in recent years. Jack Steele's forced out the door, and now we're at the other end where we've got guys like Neil, Cripps and Green.
Jai Simkin was, there was his Zach Merritt. There's a whole heap of examples now, whereas that was a... That was a rare thing. You know, I lived through it with Ryan Griffin at the Bulldogs. Before that, I'm trying to think, it was like Lee Colbert and Jeff Holger, the two that I'm trying to think of, where it was so unusual.
100%.
And now it's very much a part of the norm, which, I feel like we lose something as a footy code if that becomes just the absolute norm.
Special investigation on Four Corners last night. If you haven't seen it, you can catch up anytime through ABC iView. It was a harrowing investigation where there were...
Not an easy watch.
No, absolutely. And keep that in mind for what we're about to talk about. And as always, if any of this is challenging for you, there's always support out there available through Lifeline on 13, 11, 14. Just to step our way through it on what we saw last night. So essentially it details CTE in Australian rules football, the degenerative brain disease. It talks about the fact that CTE can be caused by repetitive trauma to the head and the body, and they are the only known causes as to how it occurs. Now, the disease is found in military personnel, in people with epileptic seizures, with domestic violence sufferers, but it has mainly been found in football players, this investigation heard. And they talked about CTE can be only diagnosed after death, and is similarly impacts the brain, like things like motor neuron disease and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and so on and so forth. There are a number of different case studies as part of this. It tells the story of young Nick Lauder, who committed suicide going back into 2023 after winning a premiership the year before with the Norwood Football Club. It talks about a former teammate of yours in Matty Robbins, among various other players. That there's a whole lot to this, and we'll try and work our way through some of the key aspects of it. But your initial reaction, Bob, as you watched on?
Yeah, it was not an easy watch. Still digesting it. It's unnerving. It feels like the further into this area we go, there's not too many nice surprises along the way. It feels like the more information we have, the more stories we hear, how far it reaches out, there's more cause for concern than there is optimism. That's how I feel at the moment. Now there's so many different ways we can attack this conversation, and I think we need to dig into it to at least a few of them. But the thing that sort of landed with me most in just the immediate aftermath was, it seems to me that the AFL, with their resources and information and the education, they have a plan and a strategy for concussion, but CTE is not concussion. CTE is these repetitive subconcussive incidents. And I found it interesting that Laura Kane was front and centre for the Four Corners piece and not Andrew Dillon. So I understand why Laura Kane would be a part of it. I think the absence of Andrew Dillon is a query for a lot of people, and I would have liked to have seen the head of the AFL in there. Laura Kane is one of the clearest thinking people I've met in footy, and there were just moments where there was hesitation.
Yep.
And I was, as I was watching and listening, I was like, what's with the hesitation? And I came away feeling like the hesitation was because of that delineation of they have a plan and research and strategy for concussion, but in terms of subconcussive hits and moments and trauma to players, what do they do? And I'm not unsympathetic to that. But if there is no strategy for that other than change the game so much that it's not the game or just stop playing, that would cause hesitation.
That they provided a clip from the 2023 Senate inquiry where essentially the question was put to Andrew Dillon and also Stephen Mead, the AFL General Counsel, about that, about the fact that they do have a policy for concussion and for head trauma, but not specifically for CTE. They were essentially asked, do you think you should have one? And they didn't have a good answer on the back of that. The other interesting point is Anita Frawley, of course.
Yeah, that was the statement that probably landed with such a thud for me and many others, I suspect.
The widow of Danny Frawley and the coronial inquest that was linked to Frawley's death in 2019 spoke about the fact that the AFL should encourage brain donation to the brain bank. Now, when Shane Tuck passed away 4 years later, the same thing was put forward by the coronial inquest, reinforced that, hey, that they should donate brains to the brain bank. And then Anita Frawley, who provided that statement to Four Corners last night, basically said, why has it taken so long? The coroner recommended this years ago, still without a clear path for brain research. The footy community deserves answers, and more importantly, the players, past, present, and future, deserve action. You mentioned Laura Kane. So she was the spokesperson for the AFL as part of this. She was asked a question at the end of the episode relating to Nick Lauder's situation and the fact that his parents weren't aware about CTE with what Nick was going through, and he'd played footy his whole life. They traced it all the way back to an underage game in which he suffered a pretty heavy fall and a clear concussion as part of that, and how his behaviour changed over time, and ultimately Lauder, as I said, committed suicide. This is how Laura Kane responded to that as in terms of the lack of knowledge for the family.
Those stories are incredibly sad. They're sad for anyone who's close to those people. You know, the story you just described is someone's son. It's really hard. What it tells me is that we all need to learn, and there's more to learn about CTE and understanding again the link between contact sports and CTE. But our job is not to communicate the research findings of others necessarily. Our job is not to communicate every single aspect of risk that you know, exists in our game. Our job is to govern our sport, and it's a shared responsibility, and it's a responsibility shared by everyone who works in contact sport.
If it's not their job, whose job is it? Is it our job? Whose job is it to educate the participants about the dangers of CTE if it's not the governing body?
But it is our job to govern the game. It feels like semantics.
Yep.
There's just that it's carefully chosen wording, which I, on one hand, I understand, but it does also feel a bit avoidant.
Yeah,
as well.
If your mission statement is always where players, health is 100% the priority. Like it's different. The NFL, the NFL have more gone down this other path now, where they basically said, "Hey,
this is the risk.
There is a link.
Yep.
There's a risk,
and we have a financial model to cater for that." Whereas the AFL doesn't seem to be going down that path yet. So, I used to be on the path of So let's stop being so critical of those in responsibility, because we just don't know enough. And again, this is only just my own personal reflection after, and I've only just finished watching it. It was almost like last night, they know quite a bit. But the answer is, well, we can put things in place for concussion, but we can't put things in place for subconcussive. So we're not going to tell you about it, because essentially it's either, well, this is what can happen, or we don't have a game.
Yeah.
That may be too simplistic, but that's how I've left feeling.
Well, we'll see the clout of that program last night, whether there's some immediate change.
Do you think there will be? The contact training seems like it's pretty front and center, doesn't it?
Yes.
The limits on that.
Yeah, yeah. That seems like a reaction to it. It's the insurance for players and some sort of a scheme to look after those who are affected by it and their families. That seems to be the main area of change that I would like to see pretty quickly.
Yeah. What do you think about the idea of raising the tackling age from 9 to 14, which was put forward as a potential change as well by one of the American experts?
It sounds good when you first hear it, and then you think learning how to be tackled and tackling properly in those formative years, you know, I just don't. You can make an argument either way, it's the same as the helmet. Oh, yeah. Let's get all the kids to wear helmets. Well, that can actually exacerbate it.
Just one on your former teammate Matthew Robbins, and there's so many individual stories here, but this is one obviously that you played with him. He's from the age of 42, he acknowledged last night that basically he started to have issues of memory loss. In fact, here's a little of Matthew Robbins' story last night as it was portrayed on Four Corners.
From the age of probably 42, I was starting to deal with memory loss and stuff.
Today, Matty is 49. He knows several fellow players now suffering dementia, and he's scared about what might lie ahead.
That's my biggest fear, that I'll develop dementia.
Can I ask you what conversations you've had with your wife about the future?
I don't want to go through dementia. I won't put my kids through that. So we'd rather come up with a solution, but I don't know what that's going to be, but I won't put my kids through that. I won't ever do that.
You're saying you don't want to leave?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to hear. Yeah, and even the vision, made it all the more intense, because you could just see the truth through his eyes as much as the words. So it's don't wish that on anyone, particularly someone you know and spent a great deal of time with and care about.
He's one of many players that have been essentially doing their best to try and get this severe injury benefit payment. So it's a lump sum of up to $600,000 for former players who have left severely injured by the game. He had his bid for compensation knocked back, which a lot of players have. Some others have received the support that is on offer there, but I think they get the opportunity to try again down the track. And he spoke about last night, look, this isn't for me. You know, I don't have any debts. He said, I'm in a good financial position. It's basically, I want to make sure that, you know.
Yeah, it was quite compelling.
Yeah.
Quite compelling.
When my brain deteriorates and essentially I can't support my family anymore, that they're looked after.
And I know, look, Laura Kane was the one brave enough to take the seat when others hadn't. But if the hesitation that I hear from headquarters is because of the potential litigation and costs and the money, it's a pretty healthy game financially. You'd like to think that those who give themselves over to it would be their families would be looked after.
Bob, appreciate your time. As always, it's a bit of a different episode for us on this Tuesday, and I appreciate you coming in on your holidays.
Likewise, mate. We'll do it again next week.
Sounds good. 5 episodes a week right here in your home of the Footy Conversation on ABC AFL Daily.